Then God said, take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on the mountain I will show you. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, Father. Yes, my son, Abraham replied. The fire and wood are here, Isaac said, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Here I am, he replied. Do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, the Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed, because you have obeyed me.
Thank you, Pastor. There's a note there about Mount Moriah. It says, Mount Moriah, the location to which God told Abraham to travel in order to sacrifice Isaac is believed by many scholars to be the precise location where Jesus was sacrificed. This is essential to understanding the lesson God is teaching us in this account. Yeah, there's a lot of layers. I mean, some of the obvious ones, Isaac and Jesus, and even the place. A piece of non-essential information that when I was researching, I learned when I was reading about Mount Moriah, what Islam believes is really interesting. They take, it's not the same story, but a similar story of the sacrifice. They have Ishmael, not Isaac, being the first son. And so he's the story. And some of the other story elements, and they may apply here, was that Ishmael and Abraham talked about this before they went up the mountain to do the sacrifice. Both accepted it as God's will, and they both went willingly. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing to see how a non-Christian religion could start with maybe the same nugget of a story, and then it grows in a really different direction from there. Pastor, maybe you comment on this because it's not really covered that well in our questions about Isaac. It doesn't seem like he put up a fight. Is there an implication there that Isaac accepted this as well? Are we kind of putting something there that's not there, and we better be careful?
The problem is that you don't have any facts or anything in the text that tells you. What you can say, though, is that, remember, God called Abraham to be in the land. Mm-hmm. So as soon as there was a drought, what did Abraham do? He went to Egypt. It was a disaster. It was a complete disaster. Later on, Lot went to the valley because it was like Egypt. And Jacob left the land. And we had that God wrestling with Jacob, very strange and wonderful story. But he shouldn't have left. And God basically forgave Isaac. never left. So that's kind of interesting. And so you could say, well, he surely must have learned a lesson from his father, you know.
Yeah.
Or learned the lesson that his father learned.
Was he 12? Isaac here?
He was older than that, although it's hard to exactly
my research didn't approximate an age either, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I think he was old enough to know what was going on, though. I think that's fair to say, right?
He was circumcised.
How do you manage?
He was 12 years old when he was circumcised, and that was before this.
Okay. Because I was thinking, how do you... Son, just lay down here. Let me tie you up. You know, it's like...
Well, that's what these... I mean, but it's speculation.
That's it's like stringing a few things together to get the implication that Isaac may have submitted himself to this as well. It's taking it a little far, but there's some clues, right? I think is about all we could say. But anyway, I thought that that story from Islam might be interesting. We don't often get that perspective. So yeah, they had Ishmael being the hero. And of course, you guys might know Ishmael ultimately traces his family lineage to Muhammad, according to the Islamists. So, there's Jesus and there's Muhammad, Ishmael, and Isaac. So it's just a very interesting little side story that, like I said, is very non-essential in getting us off in the weeds. Sorry. So.
There's some interesting things, and I didn't look ahead at the questions, but is your family your idol? Well, family was way more important to Abraham than family is to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because your family just has the importance of your relationship to your children and them to you. Family in Israel, and especially for Abraham, involves salvation. And the whole of Israel was organized, but family, clan, tribe, nation, all based on family. So which tribe you belong to and all these things are much more important than even to us.
Well, and that's in a, let's say, a spiritual sense. Even on a practical sense, your family was your social security program, it was your police, your firefighter, your workforce. It was like really everything on even on a practical minute-by-minute survival basis too, right? So, all right, finally, let's get to the questions or else we'll never get to them. I'm sorry, guys. All right, number one. It would be incredibly difficult for any parent to go through something like this. What circumstances in the life of Abraham, however, make this request from God particularly heart-wrenching? What do we know about Abraham?
He was his only son. I mean,
yeah.
Yes,
Jessica.
Well, and also God had made that promise earlier about, like, your descendants will be as numerous as the stars in the sky, and so, like, so Abraham, he sort of sees Isaac as sort of like the fulfillment of this promise, and now like he's gonna have to like kill him and have another kid, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's right.
And that he actually had to do it. It's not like, well, if you lead your son up here, there'll be somebody to kill him. He actually had to do it himself to kill his own flesh and blood.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, it'd be one thing to say, just leave this door to his bedroom unlocked and I'll take care of this for you, right? But yeah, mm-hmm. Interesting. One additional thing the author here has, it says, not only was Isaac their only child, so he's talking about the Sarah side of things now as well as Isaac, they had waited a century for him. I guess I hadn't done the mental arithmetic. They had waited 100 years for God to fulfill his promises. 100 years. Some kids don't even want to wait 100 seconds for... You'll never come to the class again. But anyway, so...
Silence's not a good idea.
Oh, she can strike me. Yes?
Switch.
Notice, too, throughout the story, how God keeps saying, your son, your only son.
Yeah,
only.
Yeah.
Because Ishmael does not matter. God told Abraham to send his first son away.
Yeah. We're not doing this your way. We're doing this my way. All right, number two. God's request in this text is strange for many reasons. For starters, it seems contradictory to his offense elsewhere over children being sacrificed. That's in Deuteronomy 12. Did God really want Isaac to die? What was he seeking here? Did God really want Isaac to die? Come on, guys, the easy one. Yes, Jesse.
He was testing to see like if Abraham would do it. You know?
Testing to see if like it's
what was it?
Strong.
What's the it?
Like do like sacrifice his family.
What's the real it behind all that?
His faith.
Yeah, that's right. Put him first.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys are right. Yeah,
Michael. I guess basically put it this way. Is Abraham willing to love his eternal father, his eternal almighty God, over his own flesh and blood?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was also another part. There was more than just compliance. I'll give you guys a hint what the author's looking for here. It was more, will you obey me? There was something else God wanted here.
Possible. Now, of course, we can look at back now. Is it possible there was kind of a prophecy about the greatest sacrifice?
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. Interesting. That isn't what I was looking for, but that's interesting. Yeah. I'll just say it. He wanted to bless him. This was gonna result in blessings. So, God wasn't just trying to get him to do tricks for him, right, or to comply or to obey. He wanted to use this as God wanted to test Abraham to see his love and strengthen his heart and ultimately strengthen their relationship. So, this is a good thing, right? I'm sure that Abraham wasn't seeing it that way. It also mentions the only way for Abraham, I don't know about only, but God's way for Abraham to have a healthy relationship with Isaac, to truly love Isaac, was to love God more than Isaac. Mm-hmm. So, really interesting. Some blessings there for Abraham.
The contrast in Deuteronomy obviously is when God says they worship their sons and daughters to their God. He doesn't mention his God, to their God. So they were sacrificing them for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, that's right. Number three, then, a child longed for as much as Isaac, back to that 100 years thing, could have very easily become the epicenter of Abraham's heart, his true source of self-worth, identity, and ultimate value. If that had indeed happened, what would the impending consequences have been? In other words, what happens when a parent puts love for a child ahead of love for God? And then I guess it talks about take it from the consequences or the effect kind of the parent who's doing that, and then maybe we could talk about that affecting the child.
You know, and, baseball, we saw this when our boys were little, and this is just taking it to a worldly example, a parallel. In baseball, you have all these parents sitting in the stands, right? And you know where I'm going. And their son or their daughter is out there, and they're living through their child. Mm-hmm. They're literally living through the child.
Yeah.
And so I think that is worship.
Yeah, I'm laughing for a very different reason. too bad Brett's not here. Every time I help assistant coach the basketball at the school, and before the season, every sports season kicks off, there's a meeting with the parents, and Matt's the athletic director, so he addresses the parents as, you know, this is what we're doing in our sports program, expectations of the coaches should be like this, like our expectation of the parents are like this, and he chose this year, I don't know why, to talk a little bit about living vicariously through your child, and saying what he was encouraging in this case was that if a parent is maybe upset about the role a child has on the team, they're not getting enough playing time, these kind of things can come up. And the point was, you know, maybe ask your child if they're uncomfortable with their role on the team. The child may very well know, I'm not playing center because I'm like 4 feet tall, you know, whatever it is. Or I don't have the gifts to do this, or I'm not a great passer, so I'm not good. And, you know, then, you know, that was Matt's point, is often it's our own pride that gets us worked up, and really the only person worked up is the parent. The child is fine, but anyway, that is that's why I was smiling, was we had covered exactly your point on, I think that was Tuesday evening, so. But anyway, getting back to this, let's talk about the effect on the parent of this kind of child at the center of the universe that we have. What's the effect on the parent? Yeah.
I think because Isaac was an adult when this happened rather than a child. If you make your children the center of your life, then when they're adults, you wipe out your ability to criticize them. And your words don't mean anything. Adult children do things that parents aren't happy about, and they're helpless. The parents are, I've talked to them, they want the pastor to do something. You know? Well, you're the parent. Most children can't stand having parents unhappy. Mm. And parents don't even use them. You know, you don't have to say, well, if you continue to do this, I'm never going to talk to you. That's ridiculous. But you can be unhappy. And that makes children very uncomfortable. I'm not disowning you, but this is not right, and I will not approve of it. That's the way it is. And if a child can really live with that, well, you really blew it when they were growing up.
The hard heart, huh? Yeah. I think you talked about this 2 weeks ago. You called about it stuck what you said. It said, don't underestimate the power of your disapproval, I think were your words. But it's the same same story. It's really, really good.
Well, we were taught from small on, you don't bring shame to the name, disappoint your father.
Sure, yeah.
And my mom and dad never raised their voice. But my sister did something, I don't remember what it was. But at Sunday dinner, everybody talked, but if she contributed, my father didn't acknowledge. It was like she wasn't.
He was shunned.
That's a good way of putting it. Anyhow, she finished, long story short, she finished high school. She didn't take. Anyhow.
Interesting. Here, I'll read this, what it says about the parent. It's interesting. The parent may place all of his or her hope, the weight of God, in a fallible little child. This will create far too much pressure. The parent will refuse to discipline his or her false God for fear of rejection. Exactly what this is exactly what Pastor was covering. Hey, Hannah.
Yeah, I do.
And then the other part is the parent may struggle with disappointment when the child doesn't meet these godlike expectations placed upon this child. If you are elevating that child to a godlike status, then watch it. They're a godlike status. So, let's see. Affecting the child. So we could talk about 1 Samuel chapter 2, 12 and 29. I don't know if anybody has that. I'm guessing that's Eli's sons, but
yeah,
go ahead.
Right here.
Spirit, okay. Technology. Yeah, technology.
From 1 Samuel 2, verse 12. And I like what it says here. Eli's sons were scoundrels. They had no regard for the Lord. There we go. And they were priests. Too. Oh, and 29, sorry about that. Thank
that's where they get theirs, right?
Skip
there just a moment.
And skips quite a few verses down. Here we go. Why do you scorn my sacrifice and offering that I prescribed for my dwelling? Why do you honor your sons more than me by fattening yourselves on the choice parts of every offering made by my people Israel? This is God probably scolding Eli.
Good.
And his sons were part of the priesthood as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they...
You don't scam it.
I think the background is he pretty much... He turned from his job to hold them accountable and let them get away with much, and then at some point they were men, they were adults, kind of like what Pastor was saying earlier, and they were gone.
Yeah, if I recall this chapter correctly, Eli himself was not scandalous in his service to God, but it was his sons, and unfortunately he lacked the backbone to hold them accountable as his fellow priests.
So more like what we call sin of omission, I guess, right? And then commission.
Yeah, that's what it appears to be.
Yeah. What about other, so yeah, you talked about some impacts onto the child of this relationship of putting love for the child ahead of your love for God. What are some other impacts on the child besides they can get away with murder or maybe even a little less than murder, but yeah. What else? Yes, Jess.
Well, I mean, if you sort of like spoil your child and like they it sort of expect everyone. Well, if you treat your child like the center of the universe, then they sort of believe that they are the center of the universe, and they expect everyone else to just sort of revolve around them.
Ding, 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 ding. That's exactly where the author was going. That's insightful, Jessica.
And they don't learn respect for authority.
That's right.
I mean, it's my way, but they don't have the full picture.
The child will eventually grow up to discover that the rest of the world does not see him or her as a god and will struggle to acclimate to the world. That's kind of a little excerpt right in the middle of it. Well, and then furthermore, ... the child will then resent the parent who failed to teach him or her the necessary life lessons. So, yeah, whether they'll say, you didn't teach me this, or whether it's more subconscious, like, you blew it. You're an idiot. I'm not going to listen to any, I'm going to shut down really any words of wisdom that might come my way from you. Okay, yeah.
You know, I was involved with the California group in high school, and there were children that came there that couldn't make it, really, in the schools, the public schools. And it was always very interesting to see them interact with our Christian friend, our Christian children, because our Christian children understood respect. They understood discipline. I'm very proud of that. And they understood, you know, there's a higher being that is judging me over and above my parents even. So if my parents blow it, you know, God is there. And they understood all that. But these other children, they just truly were lost lambs. And it's a pathetic thing to see. And like you said, Pastor, you have to go to the parents. And many times they went to the parents, and their parents just couldn't see it. And because of that, I don't know what happened to some of them. We had some foster children, and I know where they are. But I don't, you know, I pray for them.
Yeah, we have some family that live in the same town as an area Lutheran high school. I won't say which one, not CLHS. And they were kind of frustrated at times with an even stronger case of where not only would the parents would send them boarding to this high school because they didn't deal with this, and there was no accountability. And that was the fundamental thing. There's just no concept of being accountable to anything other than my own kind of desires. I am the center of the universe. My parents told me so. So
the scary thing, and so to generalize millennials, and Emily's a millennial, but like not doesn't act anything the general millennial. Like you are total non-millennial acting type.
All right, enough disclaimers. Just say it.
But the scary thing for me is there's an entire generation of entitled kids coming up that think that the world revolves around them, and I've had many of them work for me, and it's really, really hard. They don't have respect. They don't have, they just see themselves as the center of the universe. And, you know, if there's that many, it's a little scary.
Are they Christians too, or are they
likely
just
non-Christians? Like, I mean, well, they could be Christians, or they may be. Well,
because
but,
I don't think it's, I mean, I understand if you're brought up with your Christian faith and background, but I know kids who have gone to Christian schools, and sometimes they're not behaving real
totally,
well.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's.
So I just didn't know if you had experience with this. Christian or millennial.
Whether somebody says they're Christian or not, you can't, like,
yeah.
But it's hard to tell, but,
And unfortunately, too, we're now getting this whole thing with campus, political correctness, all that other little safe space and all that, because kids are being so oversensitive, being told, well, some people believe abortion's wrong, or homosexuality or transgenderism is wrong, and they're like crybabies. Oh, I don't want to hear that. And those of us who oppose are being kicked out. And here's the funny thing, it's really almost ridiculous. A couple weeks back at UC Berkeley, at this famous Sather Gate, a bunch of other, you know, non-Caucasian students wanted to block off the main gate for white students because of the safe spaces and all that. Like other races, like Caucasians are the bad people and all that stuff. And they were blocking off. Mm-hmm. And it would go all this stuff about free speech zone, you know, safe zones or free speech zones, this or that. And then, you know, are you guys familiar with 1984, the book by George Orwell? Well, let's just say the thought police is everywhere.
Let's talk about how this affects God in this scenario. Where's God in this? We talked about the parent. We talked about the child. When the child is the center of the universe and not God, where does that land us?
Well, he is a jealous God, and he's always supposed to come first, and it's complete disrespect if you are a Christian, if you're putting your child before God.
Yeah. Yes.
It's like money, almost. Putting something above God is making it a God, and there's only one God, and you can't make more than just him.
Yeah, it's his place, and nobody else is going to be in it. So there's definitely all that kind of brimstone stuff, but there's an interesting part in here. It says, furthermore, he is saddened that this disordered love will bring future complication and hurt into the lives of the parent and the child. So that's kind of interesting. He knows where this is going, right? And he just sees it, and it's just like as parents or grandparents, we sit there and we just watch it play out. We know exactly what's going to happen, and it's hard to watch. So how much more for God to sit there and watch this play out? Number four, after Abraham demonstrated a willingness to sacrifice Isaac, God intervened. He said, now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son, to your point, Pastor, earlier, again and again. Did God not know what was in Abraham's heart? Who really learned something here, and what was that lesson? Was God so happy that he finally got it here? Okay. Yes.
You know, it's so funny how God almost the way God speaks, and forth. Well, of course, how he spoke in the garden. Where are you, Adam and Eve?
Yeah.
But God knew all along.
Yeah.
Did God, who told you this? Who told you about me for all that? I think when God comes to us, I think he communicates in a way where he really knew all along because he's omniscient. But I think it's just how he communicates to us. But what it came down to is for Abraham's sake. And also Israel to, you know, glorify God and also be a sort of a witness to our priorities, what our priorities need to be at all times and on all ages.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Definitely God didn't learn something here. Mm-hmm. Abraham did, and you know, what else did he learn? Yeah.
In my Bible said Abraham's faith is confirmed by his obedience.
Confirmed to who?
Confirmed by his obedience. This Abraham's faith.
Yeah. And I think the person it was confirmed to was to Abraham himself, right? I don't think God needed to know this, but yes.
I think one of the problems we have with Bible stories that are difficult, like this one, or like God wrestling with Jacob, another one, is that we want to put ourselves in the position of God. Well, God didn't learn anything here. Well, that's not the way the story is presented. Mm. You know? And you have to describe, why couldn't God defeat Jacob? God couldn't beat
Jacob. Is there a rock too big that God can't move it?
He really could have. He really could. No, he couldn't. Why are you saying he really could have when he didn't? You know, because we want the story to fit our ideas. We don't want to wrestle with things being uncomfortable. You know, God is telling us the story from a human point of view, not from God's point of view.
Yeah, he's condescending down to us.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And we don't like that. We need an answer. We got to have an answer. So did God really know what was in Abraham's heart? Well, why is that an important question? That's not the way the story is presented.
Mm.
I wouldn't ask that question.
No, that's probably right, but maybe we all need to knock ourselves down a bit, and then now we can continue with the lesson. But yeah, that's the only reason I could think why the author might
and
ask
that. If you
that,
want
yeah.
the story to be really tough, God asked Abraham to go and sacrifice his son. It took him 3 days to get there. That's two awful nights. Did he sleep for 3 days thinking about this? This is a really difficult story. And you don't want to have an easy answer
to resolve
it.
When Isaac asked his father, where's the sacrifice?
Yeah. Stab in the heart.
Yeah.
Stab in the heart.
The knife that had been there for 3 days just got twisted again, right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong. I don't think that God, did God know what was in his heart? Well, I think he probably did, but that's not what the story is about.
No. So what is the lesson? What is the story about here to this one? Yeah, what is the lesson? To answer the author's question.
Walking God's way is very difficult. And if we didn't have, well, we're going to get to the, you know, is Isaac Jesus? Never in the New Testament is this story ever used.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? I think it is. I mean, I'm not saying it isn't.
Really, a Christotype or whatever that fancy
is. It's a really difficult story, and if you don't put yourself in the position of Abraham, then you have easy answers. When your kid wants something, and it really isn't a good idea for him to get it, then you need to stand firm, and that's easy. You don't spend two sleepless nights thinking about it.
Mm.
You know, and you give in easily. God is tough.
I mean, you, as you said, Isaac is not Christ, or a Christ, or Jesus, but...
I don't know.
At one point, I was thinking... Well, at one point, I was thinking about... You talk about agonizing as you were talking about the 3 days. Think of Jesus walking the earth for 30 years. And the Gethsemane, we got a little glimpse of the agony. Just to look, we carried that around for 30 some years. And, wow. Yeah, it really, you start unraveling the onion, peeling the onion, as they say. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the takeaways in this is that walking with God is not easy either. You know, talk about sleepless nights. I think we've all, as parents, been many sleepless nights or weeks, whether it's our family or our extended family. God does not want this earth to be a paradise that we never want to leave. We're always going to be looking towards heaven.
No, you're right. I'll read what the author says. It's exactly where you two guys were going. Through this test, Abraham learned where his own allegiances lay. Moving forward, he now had a profound working knowledge for how easy human relationships could potentially get in the way of a relationship with God. And here's the part. And also the cost it would take for him to be in God's family or walk God's way, let's say. So yeah, you get that. We nailed it. That's really profound what you guys said. Number five then, how does the story of Abraham and Isaac find its culmination in Jesus?
God's only son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
because
definitely part of it.
God's only son and gave his life for us.
Yeah, there wasn't another one, and think about Abraham and Sarah. Didn't seem too likely another one was coming along either at that point.
The other thing too is really realizing God's love. I think that most of us could imagine giving ourselves for someone else.
Jumping in front of a bullet. Yeah.
That's dramatic, but
yeah.
Or in other ways. But who of us can imagine giving up your child?
Yeah, her in front of me. Right.
Yeah.
That bullet, right.
That's what the father did.
Yeah.
So you
Well, he said, in 3 days from now, a bullet is coming. I want you to take your daughter and put, right? And that's the agonization.
She was offering up Jacob's. Just take him, take him.
Only son, right? Not only daughter.
All your parenting jobs are getting done.
Yeah, this is great. You need to come each week.
Be careful, you might, your time might come up.
Yeah.
Because if she leads a lesson someday, if you're one of the students in class, watch out.
That's true.
She might be on the other foot. Huh? Yeah. This is a little excerpt here that has some interesting from the answer. In the person of Jesus, God demonstrated willingness to temporarily part with family and see family suffer in order to make family greater by means of addition. So that's interesting. Nothing was going to get in his way. He put his family on hold for a while. So I thought that was an interesting little passage. And then, yes?
You know, in all of this Bible study that we had today, we talked about the parent as the family. But then, and I think this was very, I could see this, the child also is the family, you know, and the child brings to the family a lot of dynamics. And sometimes the children in their innocence, which I think is what you were referring to, their innocence, speak up on the importance of the family and what it means to them. It's their security, it's their trust, it's their place to go for rest and peace. And the children expect that because you've nurtured them. And I see that in Jesus, I mean, in his prayers to his father.
Yeah, that's really good. Let me put one little challenge, though. Is that, in that case, the child putting the family in between himself or herself and God, and they're maybe expecting things that really should be coming from God, coming from my family. I suppose there's even a line there, mm-hmm. right?
That's right.
Especially if the child's been lucky enough to have a nurturing home and in a home where things are maybe, some of the times anyway, put in the right order and all of that. Could the child actually start relying on the family in place of God? And, you know, it gets interesting. Okay, so that's number 5. Bonus time. All right, we're in overtime. One of the ways we know we're treating something or someone as a false god is if we're breaking the true God's commands in order to serve that thing or person. What are some of the ways in which idolizing family could lead to breaking God's commands? Oh, we just kind of covered one with family. Yeah. What else? There's some kind of interesting ones here. So, how can we take family too far? Who's that, Jessica?
Well, there's the whole like sin of omission, like with Eli and stuff. Like you could like just not like if you see like your son or your child like doing like something that's not very good, but you don't like do anything about it, then like.
No, that's actually one of them. You got it. Michael, did you have one?
No, I've kind of heard two, but I think the bonus question too has some things to say, especially in this day and age too right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'll restate what Jess said a little bit. Desire for family peace may lead us to ignore God's command for parental discipline or spiritual accountability, right? And letting it go, doing the Eli thing, may kind of be the easy thing until the snowball has gotten so big and then it runs you over, right, eventually. But yeah, that was one of them. What else do you guys see here, maybe?
Well, I have talked with someone a couple years ago, and that I was seeing them, but with the two services, you know. And she explained to me that I should know both her and her husband worked, and Sunday morning is their family time.
Ding, so ding, you got one.
Yeah, I got same.
This is like Family Feud where they reveal the answer. You got one.
So they go out and eat and do do family things on Sunday morning.
Can't do family being like worship.
That was not
well, some families get involved in sports. And knowing that if my child is really going to excel, he'll have to be involved every Sunday.
That's right.
In doing this. Yeah? Very common.
Yeah, we hit that a little bit the other week when we were talking about sports idols. But Jeanette used family time. They chose a different air quotes. Spending quality time with the family at the expense of worshiping together as a, as a family. So. Yeah, why is quality time in church take us two directions, right? But yeah, another topic for another time. But there was one other one, and this reaches back to last week's technology discussion. Kelly and I were talking about, on the drive over here, we probably could have gotten hit harder with the technology stick last week than we were, but I'll read this to you. Pursuing a family that looks perfect may lead to lying about how things are really going, either by word or by picture. Facebook has become a notoriously popular way of trying to create the illusion of an ideal family and life. Right? I mean, how many Facebook, when there's a bad moment, oh, let's put that on Facebook. No. You know, there's not so much of that. But that's a, kind of the intersection of Facebook and or using technology to further another idol of how perfect my family is. All right, we have a few minutes. Let's hit these couple verses from Luke. Does anybody have that in front of them, Luke 14?
Yeah. Okay. If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Very strong words.
Interesting. By the way, something in that just triggered another thing I learned when I was doing some research. They were likening Jesus carrying the cross, which you talk about taking up your cross, and Isaac carrying the wood, the bundle of wood for the sacrifice. Just there's all these layers. It's the Bible's, it's really beautiful, even just the literary aspect of it. But anyhow, I'm getting us off on a track.
That's very good.
Yeah, it was just layers and layers, right? So, hate family? Jesus is using hyperbole here. How does Matthew 10 shape our understanding of what Jesus is saying in Luke's gospel?
Well, as I can remember when we were having our Bible studies on words in the Bible that are difficult to understand, this is
way up there, yeah.
Remember that came up? And I was so relieved when that came up, and forgive me for not remembering, but it said, hate here, Jesus was making a point. Because in the rest of the Bible, everything you learn, Jesus loved. And his life was full of love for family, for sinners, for everyone. But he wanted to make a point here. You know, don't put anyone in front of God, your Father. Was that right?
Sure. And
I got something out of the Bible study.
One way of making a point is what we said, hyperbole.
Yeah.
You go to the extreme to make the point. I mean, everybody knew that Jesus didn't want you to hate.
I was relieved at that.
Here's a fancy one. Make this good to make the leader look smart. Jesus is using Semitical rhetorical devices. Some of you guys had learned that as well. In the religious circles of that days, the rabbis. A lot of times that's how they challenge each other, beat on each other with questions in order to get to the true meaning. So are you saying that, well, you're saying hate your family? No, you're saying you don't hate your family? I mean, it was kind of the means. It was this rhetorical hyperbole, stretching the point to make the point kind of. I guess it's a pretty common way of teaching, just kind of beating each other up until they got eventually to the nut of the answer. But ultimately, it's about love. And here's what the author says. Jesus is suggesting that unless someone loves him more than anyone else, father, mother, spouse, child, that person will be unable to appropriately love the other person. So it's kind of back to that. I have a blessing here for you. If you could get out of your own way, I could give it to you. If you can get this relationship right, then maybe this one works a little better. Number three, then, what is the perfectly logical reason to hate by comparison our lives and close relationships here on earth? And I guess the author leads you to the conclusion here.
I don't know if it's the answer here, but I think one of the things right now, again, is the sexual morality issue, being transgender or gay. Because unfortunately right now there are a lot of kids who are sexually confused or whether they feel they want to love the same sex or change their gender. And unfortunately, there are parents out there, there are stories out there, oh, it's okay, we'll support you, do it, we'll encourage you. Or the other way, or that. And as parents, or these parents would be saying, no, it's a sin, it's wrong. Yes, you know what? If you hate me as your mom or dad, fine. But I have to love God more and his commands more. And it's unfortunately, there are a lot of new parents out there, and there's stories about that throughout Facebook or other social media right now. There's stories that are, they're enabling their kids to do whatever their little feelings are at the moment. And unfortunately, are the parents loving their children at the expense of loving God and his commands? And I, like I said, the moral issues are, the, to me, the test grounds of where you're going to stand for God's truth or stand for the world and Satan.
Interesting. Your choice of relationship is an interesting one. Because that isn't necessarily where the author went, but it's interesting you went there. That one is a relationship that God would be clear. That's a bad relationship. That's against my laws.
And the sad part is that unfortunately a lot of Christians who have given into that right now too.
Yeah.
And as well as abortion. So
yeah.
I know it's a two core. I know there seem like a lot has been said about it, especially with our election coming up here. But to me, I think it's a test of what Christians must stand for. It might put us to the test too, as far as our faith goes. As far as are we going to stand for that? Are
Interesting.
We hold our faith right now,
friend.
My answer is just more of a general answer, but I think a reason to quote-unquote hate our lives and what we have here on earth is to keep our focus heavenward and to realize that whatever is going on in our lives here with people or whatever, that we should not be grasping onto that because our eyes should be focused on God and in heaven and you know what's waiting for us there.
That's absolutely where the author went. I mean, when I was reading this the first time, or maybe even just hearing myself read it now, what Michael said is very interesting, that those are detestable relationships to Christians, right? It's easy for us to beat them up. What about the really good, close relationships? Those are maybe harder for us, these close personal relationships. Mm-hmm. What if it's a very God-pleasing relationship? We talked about parents and children and stuff, but kind of get the ends of the spectrum there. That's interesting. I guess we can keep plowing ahead for another couple of minutes. Joshua. Does anybody happen to have Joshua 24 accessible to them? I know there's Bibles in this room. You got it, Hannah?
Almost.
Yeah, it's
in the conversion.
What?
New version?
Yep.
verse 14 and 15, will you read it?
Mm-hmm. Long. All right. Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your ancestors worshipped beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord.
Thank you. So there were two gods here. I'll skip to it. There was gods of our ancestors, gods of the Amorites. What do these look like? And if we translate those to 2016, not too many Amorites running around, I know. But, well, maybe there are in another form. But gods of our ancestors. What does that mean? How do we translate that to today?
Old gods?
They're
awful. Now, I'm not positioning it very well. I'll just read it. These gods, these are the idols that come through descendants. They're generational consequences. They could differ from family to family and culture to culture, but they're based on poor influences of parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and so on. So it's the things we've worked ourselves into. Maybe great-grandpa had a fishing lodge and every Sunday he went fishing, so grandpa did it, and then mom and dad did it and we do it. So that could be an example, but they're these gods of our ancestors repeating the bad behavior generation after generation.
Kind of superstitions and crazy traditions.
Yeah, substance abuse, a lot of times you see that can be a generational kind of consequence. Maybe verbal abuse, you know, grandpa, you always yelled at grandma, and then dad yells at wife, and, you know, just these kind of consequences is one. Then the other one is the gods of the Amorites. So this goes back to something Pastor was mentioning earlier about being in the land. So what are some of the gods of the land that we're in now? We make this 2016.
Money.
Say it louder.
Money.
Money, yeah.
Your position.
Oh.
Your position. If you work.
Success.
Success.
Yep.
Yes.
That's there.
What about the whole spiritual thing? Because that's became like the new religion.
Yeah.
Sure.
I like the
inner peace or
yoga.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Those are good. All right, guys, we're at the point we need to stop. So there's a... we got to the one-yard line and didn't shove it into the end zone. Sports idol. Didn't shove it in the end zone. So, okay, why don't we close with a quick word of prayer. I don't think they gave us one. But, all right, we'll pray and then we'll be on our way. Lord, thank you for, again, bringing us together. Thanks for revealing to us some important lessons from your word. Help us to put these things into practice during the week. Amen.
Amen.